session number 27074, reel 13.
Squadron Leader Cyril Bamberger, reel 13. One of the things that interested me in the story that you were recounting there about flying the last serviceable Hurricane, what were the reasons for so many aircraft being unserviceable at that time with 185?
Well, we'd been engaged in combat for roughly, say, 2 weeks. And obviously aircraft do go and so for normal reasons, you know, things go wrong. And so normal unserviceability, probably an engine change so we only happen to have two. Probably, in fact, somewhere I've got hidden away that I think it was something like 4 days later before they had any aircraft serviceable. But they may have ended up with 6 or 10 serviceable, you know, it just...
What were the facilities for like for servicing the aircraft on the airfield?
Not really being involved in it, or at that time particularly interested in it. In fact, I probably was not interested in it at all. I vaguely remembered how far they had some hangars. I vaguely seem to remember, which had belonged to the Navy, I think, because the Navy had originally been at how far. And so I presume they were serviced there, so probably the facilities were not too bad. But at that stage, and my rank and everything, I wouldn't say I couldn't care less, because the more aircraft was serviceable, the better. But obviously I was not involved in it, and that was somebody else. That was Boy Moyle's headache, and the engineering officer's headache.
Was there a problem with spares, though, at all?
Going back to 261 Squadron very briefly, I vaguely recollect, remember you're talking about a long time ago, that, you know, you repaired Hurricanes the outside with fabric, and they put a piece of fabric, put red dope over it, and that was, so, you know, your aircraft, some of them were somewhat patched up. Now then, again, I don't know whether I'm repeating something that somebody else has said, or I actually saw it, seen it, but I vaguely remember we ran out of tires for our Hurricanes, and at one stage we didn't put air in them, but we put straw in them. But again, I cannot recollect seeing that happen, because I would have been involved in it anyway. And probably if they put straw in our tires instead of air, we wouldn't have looked anyway. So that's one of those I could not say. But there's no doubt about it. I mean, by equivalent standards of aircraft flying at that time in England, our Hurricanes were clapped out.
Another thing that struck me very much about your operations, specifically over the harbour, was how dangerous was it flying through all that anti-aircraft fire?
Anti-aircraft fire, and it probably pertained to bombers as well, certainly on D-Day, when they were going over the beaches, anyone on the ground who sees an aircraft shoots at it. It's I won't talk about it later on in the war, but so all that stuff going up into the air, you're just as liable to hit by it as the enemy aircraft are. And if you are, example, I can't say I actually did this, but if a JU-87 is diving down or just passing over the illustrious and you're behind it, they're probably not giving enough deflection and you get more of the ammunition than the JU-87. And that went on right through the war. That was just, you suddenly came back with a hole in your aircraft and you didn't know quite where it had come from or what it was, but it was just a bit of metal. And you used to find it in odd places, you know, floating around in the aircraft sometimes. An odd thing I'll mention, there's not particularly Malta, but I think you would turn an aircraft upside down in whatever particular situation. And the things that came out and hit the canopy could be anything from old rags to spanners to bits of metal to anything.
You also mentioned earlier one incident where you were particularly, the pilots were strafed at Takali,
yeah,
by the German Air Force. You also said that they attacked the airfield on another occasion.
Yes. Well, I remember crawling out from somewhere and looking at two of our Hurricanes on fire when we'd been strafed. I cannot remember the instance that I decided when I dived under a bus. I know there were 110s because I saw them coming towards me. Hence the rapid exit. But the others could probably 110s, but if not, 109s, I should think.
And
an interesting part on that, because until that happened, we used to sit in our Hurricanes for about 2 hour spells at a time, strapped in, all ready to take off, to get off, try and get some height. And I used to, his nickname was Dracula, it was another sergeant pilot, can't remember his other name. I used to play chess with Dracula. We had little pocket sets, and we had the airmen running from the one aircraft to the other, doing the moves to pass the time away, which of course it was very hot sitting in an aircraft, very uncomfortable. And of course, if a raid came over and took you by surprise, you were very, very vulnerable. So we obviously probably stopped that practice after the strafing incident.
Now, you mentioned obviously leaving Malta on a Sunderland flying boat, heading in the opposite direction to where most people went. Was there any reasoning behind you being sent home that way, do you think?
I can only say, and I could be completely wrong, but because it probably is being boastful now, I was only, by that stage, as regards fighters are concerned, I was certainly the longest serving sergeant pilot on the island. And probably my very brief meeting with O'Halloran, he must have thought what I had to say was useful to him. And as I was the longest serving sergeant pilot, remember the longest serving officer was Chubby Elliott. He was the officer, and he stayed there when I left for a little while. he was a flight commander then under Boy Mild. But that's all I can say, is that I was along a service sergeant pilot, and I'd done, I admit it was only a fortnight one of the squadron, but you know, it was another effort, where all the others had gone back to Egypt.
Had there been a large rate of casualties during the period you were there amongst pilots?
I could find out amongst the... Remember, people were being fed in, which is always difficult to specifically state. And I'd never been asked this question before. And I'd have to you to stop the tape, if you would wish, because the only way I could give you odd two losses when I was with 261 and briefly 185 Squadron, I think they would be on a par with the Battle of Britain. Probably as frequently the losses, probably they were lost in the sea, most of them. There were some crashed on the island, most of them lost in the sea, so they were, that was it. And it was, I don't think you dwelt on it any more than you did in my previous experience, because people came and went anyway, and if they'd been shot down and killed, well, they'd been shot down and killed, they'd just gone. You didn't dwell on it, on a lost friendship or anything like that. Or certainly I didn't, because if you'd done that, I don't think you'd have got very far, survived. It was just, he'd had his chips and it was just bad luck.
Because it's interesting, the impressions that people get since the war of how squadrons form, that they are kept as a group of people.
Yeah.
But you seem to be suggesting it's a much more fluid and dynamic thing, that people come all the time and disappear, and you may not know where they've gone or why they've gone.
Well, pilots, new pilots, were always being fed in. I don't mean month by month, or, you know, maybe 3 months. But remember, you had losses. You had people who were arrested. I mean, some people were arrested after a very short period, you know, so it was assessed medically or by the CO that they were better to be arrested than stay where they were. So people just disappeared. And then new people were fed in, and then casualties had to be replaced. And I don't think I can comment on that any more than that.
How did you feel about leaving the island? Because obviously you were upset when you arrived back from the flight with Sergeant Wynne. But how had you felt after that amount of time on the island?
I was, you'd probably say I should say, or someone should think I should say, I'm sorry to be going away for it, and, you know, all the action and things like that. I was delighted to leave. And how I got my seat, the Sunderland, well, it had more than one, but I was given a gunnery position, metal seat where you sit with an open, and I think it was a Lewis gun that you had, and I sat in, most uncomfortable, I sat in this Lewis gun for the flight to Gibraltar, and then from Gibraltar to Plymouth. I would have been a use if the sun had been attacked, but I knew how to use a Lewis gun. But at every sort of about 2 hours, someone would come up from the depths of the sun and give me a cup of tea. and that kept me going. But I mean, that flight home was absolutely, we were a bit nervous for, from obviously I picked it up from the crew. I mean, I'd only ever met the pilot of the aircraft, but the crew coming through saying, because there was a German sort of aircraft that used to roam the Bay of Biscay looking for sort of a...
Condor.
That's the word, you've got the word condor, do you remember? I don't. And one of those had found us, of course, wouldn't, I'd have probably used my machine gun to no effect, but I think that was the, going through the Bay of Biscay, I think, was the only place we were really nervous or in the aircraft. But it was quite another experience.
Were you ready to go home? You said you were delighted, but were you ready from obviously the daily, the combat week? I suppose you were, or would you have wanted to go straight to an operational squadron when you returned?
No, when I first returned to the UK, I went, oddly enough, it wasn't a pilot gunnery training school, but I went to the central gunnery school. So I immediately went into gunnery training. And it was after about 3 months of that, of what I call routine training, I won't bore you with the details, that I got itchy feet again and put in an application to go back onto operational flying.
So it sounds like you were quite ready for a relatively short break, but yes. You hadn't... You were ready to go back to operational flying, I would say, relatively quickly.
Well, yes, I was bored to tears with it. I thought it was dreadful. After war experience, just playing about an aeroplane and being in war was not my scene at all. So, I mean, though I've probably said a number of things, what I call, not say adverse about myself, but sort of on the negative side, obviously... Deep down, I was fairly aggressive.
I was going to say, what is it about operational flying that you liked or enjoyed, I guess?
I think probably adrenaline. It kept me alive.
And obviously with the Central Gunnery School, a completely different environment.
It was dreadful.
Do you think your posting there was because of your operational experience in Malta?
No, I think... Well, it was, yes. Because the Central Gunnery School, you wanted a fighter pilot. So it was because I was a fighter pilot. But obviously, someone in the military said, obviously, rest. And I was sent to a rest job. I could have been sent to an operational train to train people how to fly Spitfires or something like that, but instead I went to the Central Gunnery School.
Would that be the kind of thing that the RAF would do, though, when you returned? Would you be given a non-operational tour then?
Oh, definitely, yeah. In England, yeah.
You were there for... until April 42?
Yeah.
What happened to your applications when you were trying to get back to an operational squadron? Because you said you were after 3 months.
Well, MAC was one example. I put an application at Central Gunnery School. I've still kept it, actually. You know, just very roughly handwritten, signed by the wing commander, saying he'd do something. But what he did, which was, I said, so very... I was part of the Central Gunnery School, which was divided into divisions, and there was a pilot gunnery wing just started by Sailor Milan. And he recommended that I went on to the Sailor Milan side. And Sailor Milan put me on number 3 course. So when I'd finished number 3 course, I was then had to go and earn my keep being a pilot gunnery instructor. That's when I was sent over to Northern Ireland to teach the Americans how to shoot. That's another long story. But that's where McLaughlin, flying his metal hat with his metal arm, came to see me in Northern Ireland and to air headquarters there to get me transferred to his squadron. I was commissioned by then. He was turned down. They wouldn't let me go.
Can you tell me what your role was as an instructor? Just what an instructor would do at that stage of the war?
Well, basically, in Northern Ireland, I had part of mother spare aircraft. I had two Lysanders for towing drogues. I had a shed full of guns to demonstrate how guns worked and things like that. I had a Mars Master with guns, two guns, Mars Master. And my main job, I had a pilot, or sometimes one, sometimes two, sometimes none, to fly, to tow a drogue. And I used to put when I was with the American squadron, the American pilots in the front seat, and I'd show them how to come into attack and how much lead to give on the drogue. And I'd go out with them and do some runs with it, firing the gun. We'd land, put new ammunition in with new coloured markings on them. We used to mark bullets with colours. And they'd go up and fire on the drogue. And the drogue would come back and see him being boastfully. I'd say, got 20 blue hits, and there'd be one red. And I'd say, well, you haven't quite got the hang of it yet. And the other thing, my drogue pilot would report back that the pilot was flying over from the stern and nearly shooting him down. But I used to lecture them before we went off on deflection and range and have you switched that off yet? It's off.
It's running.
Oh, sorry. I used to lecture on range, but jumping ahead later on in the war when I was in other squadrons, being a gunnery expert then, I used to look, and we all had camera guns then, I should say well in excess of 50% of pilots were shooting way out of range. Hadn't got the message.
What was your impressions of these Americans you were training? Because they must have been amongst the very first Americans to arrive in the UK.
Well, they were an unusual group. They'd been flying aerocopters, and they came to Northern Ireland to convert to Spitfires. And there were the Spitfire wings that went to North Africa. Flown by Americans, and they were reasonably successful, because at that stage, despite them producing lots of aircraft, the Americans hadn't got an aircraft really suitable. And in fact, I met the same wing that I trained at the Salerno landings.
Had they trained? Obviously, they'd done pilot training.
Oh, they'd done pilot training.
Had they done any gunnery training prior to?
Well, they must have done, but the Spitfire was totally different from a thing like an aerocopter, which I think had one cannon coming through, and it had a nose wheel, of course. And landing a Spitfire compared to, or taking off a Spitfire compared with an aerocopter was such a different thing, and they got this habit of pushing the stick forward, landing and things like that. And it was an interesting experience. I didn't train them how to fly. I only came in when they could fly the Spitfire or thought they could fly the Spitfire.
Did they have any problems with the weather?
Yes, dreadful problems with the weather. In fact, and that's how I learned to play poker. Because the weather in Northern Ireland is not so good. Where they'd all been trained, it was 24-hour-a-day sunshine, because that's how they trained their pilots, unfortunately. They hadn't trained them for European weather in any shape or form. And in Northern Ireland, you daren't let them loose if there were many clouds about, sort of thing. Slight exaggeration, but they weren't an instrument flying group at all, so had to wait. And so they taught me how to play poker. They taught me very well, actually.
But their flying abilities, it was something you would have to be aware of while you were gunnery training them, would it?
Oh, yeah, yes. I mean, because, I mean, they had to be able to... because I wouldn't have let them loose flying at someone towing a drogue unless, you know, sort of they were producing results. I mean, if someone came back and flying Spitfire, shooting at a drogue, and he hadn't hit the drogue, I took him up again.
Things sound very much like they've changed from your own training period in 1940 when you'd received very little gunnery training.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Did you try and impart as much of your experience as you could while you were training with gunnery?
It doesn't seem odd now, but it was odd at the time. There was these... Fresh, totally inexperienced, even the CO. Any knowledge of air warfare, really. Obviously, they'd done training in America, you see, but there was, as I was a flying officer at the time, flying officer, flown in the Battle of Britain, flown in Malta, teaching them. So, in that respect, everything that came out of my mouth were words of wisdom. Even if it was absolute rubbish.
And they were prepared to listen, were they?
Oh, very prepared, yes. Well, purely because what I'd been involved in.
It sounds interesting because you're imparting your knowledge, which seems a very useful thing to do, and I'm comparing it back to, obviously, the training you received.
Yeah.
Was that becoming more of an ethos among, say, your fellow instructors at that time?
Oh, yes. I mean, see, we're talking 1942, isn't it? I mean, things were getting very organised then. Things were getting much more organised.
And I assume that any detail that you could give them could sometimes, A, save their lives or improve their skills.
Yes. But as I say, I wasn't teaching them to fly. I was only teaching them how to shoot.
But would there be an element? Would there be an element that you would discuss aerial combat with
them?
Oh, yes.
Non-stop virtually. Because, I mean... Remember, you know, they knew nothing.
Because obviously, when you were telling about earlier on, there was the idea of not really talking shop.
Yeah.
Had that changed as well by that stage? Would you discuss with them tactics or gunnery and
yes, I mean basically, I was teaching them how to shoot. There are other pilots there teaching them how to fly. You see, so I mean, they covered certain aspects of it. But when we got together in the mess, their food was wonderful. the food in Northern Ireland, anyway, was wonderful. And then with all their luxuries, having pineapple with eggs and bacon for breakfast. Oh, dear, after starving in Malta. Wonderful. Anyway, that's enough of that.
And there's one last question for today. At that point, you were commissioned as well.
Yes, I was commissioned at the Central Gunnery School, yes.
How did you feel about that after all those years?
I thought it was wonderful because by volunteering for Malta, I'd missed the boat on commissioning. Because when I returned from Malta, still as a sergeant, most of my contemporaries who were alive, well, there were quite a few dead, some of them were flight lieutenants, and I was still a sergeant. So I had a long, I never caught up quite, but it was, I was delighted, it was wonderful.